Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and with us now in the studio is Gwenifar Roller, owner of Old Books on Front Street, prolific writer, known for her Live Local column in Encore magazine, as well as her theatrical reviews. She also now writes for Salt magazine, and she's a regular commentator here at WHQR. Gwenifar, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. I don't know if anybody could live up to that introduction, but thank you.
Well, if anyone can, it's you. And Gwenifar, you are with us today because you're adapting a screenplay to the stage. And before we have you talk about it, I just want to say NPR's Bob Mondello calls the film the worst movie ever made. So there's a mountain to climb right there. So let's have comedian Patton Oswalt introduce the movie, shall we?
And it's called Deathbed, the bed that eats people. I'm not making, go IMDb this. This is a real movie. Deathbed, the bed that eats people. And it's about a bed that's evil and it eats people. That's the whole movie. This guy wrote Deathbed, the bed that eats people, took it to a second guy and said, okay, it's called Deathbed, the bed that eats people. Now the backstory is, there's a demon, and then the second guy said, stop drilling, you hit oil. You had me at deathbed. We are going to rent cameras, buy film stock, hire a crew. We are shooting this masterpiece.
And that is comedian Patton Oswalt from his album Werewolves and Lollipops. Yes. So Gwenifar,
I noticed that that's the cut down G-rated version to make the FCC happy.
Yeah, that was the only part that we could find that would fit those parameters.
Yeah.
So Gwenifar, why are you trying to adapt the worst movie ever made?
Well, can I tell you the backstory of how I got into this?
Sure.
Okay. So I write about playwrights for Salt magazine. And last year, I was at a show that Big Dog was doing that I was reviewing for Encore, and Steve Vernon came out and did his curtain speech and said, and we're going to have a Halloween Horror Festival, and we're going to have original shows by different playwrights every weekend, all on the theme of Halloween, and he gave some examples. I was like, mental note, I need to call him and talk about the playwrights and cover it. And I walked into the meeting with Steve to talk about the playwrights that were going to be writing for the festival, and I walked out of the meeting, and somehow I had found myself writing a stage adaptation of Deathbed, and my first thought was, oh God, I have to call Shay and explain this because I'm going to lose my job. because as a theater reviewer, there are a lot of things you're not supposed to do, and that would be one of them. But she had been hearing Deathbed stories from Jock and myself for so long that I think she was just kind of tickled by the idea, and I got a free pass this one time. and that was definitely the cut-down G-rated version of Patton's speech about Deathbed. But Deathbed is the movie nobody's ever seen. It was made in 1973, and it never officially got released until 2004. And my connection to it is that the grand passion of my life is a man named Jock Brandis, who a lot of people know as the founder of the Full Belly Project. And he worked on Deathbed in 1973. He was the lighting designer. I think he owned the camera that they used. And he built the eating mechanism that made the bed eat. And he also dies in it.
The eating mechanism. Well, since we just heard from Patton Oswalt and you introduced Jock and his participation in this movie, let's hear from Patton again on that point.
A carpenter drove nails into wood building the deathbed, probably tore his shoulder out, you know, his rotator cuff, couldn't play catch with his son growing up. Now the son grows up to resent him, and his dad's going, you know what, he'll finally understand when he sees Deathbed, the bed that eats people.
And so there's an allusion in there also to Jock's son Darwin, who happens to be married to Kate Brandis, who happens to work in underwriting here at WHQR. So it all becomes very real. Yes. Yes. So first of all, Gwenifar, you said to me there were many hurdles to be cleared when adapting Deathbed to the stage. For example, the film completely lacks a plot arc and characterization. Yeah. How do you write that?
Well, that was sort of a shock. that was really one of those moments where I was like, there is no actual plot arc to the movie. There is no beginning, middle, and end. And how am I going to turn that into a stage show? And so one of the things that Steve and I talked about a lot was that the making of the movie is hysterical. The making of the movie is ridiculous. And also for me, a lot of Jock stories from the movie industry sort of came together with this movie, because living with Jock is like living with a lot of real big fish stories. At a certain point, you lose track of what they're all about because there's so many of them and they're all so good. And I was like, oh, this is the movie where you got thrown out of a whorehouse in Detroit. Okay. All right. I got it. Oh, this is the movie when you had to smuggle a skeleton across an international border. Okay. That's it. And so there's...
So are you making this up, or are these actual things?
These are real things that happened to Jock in the making of Deathbed, which will be in the play. And by the way, we finally have a title for the play, which came together. So the movie is Deathbed, the Bed That Eats, and the play is Deathbed, the Play That Bites. But it's, yeah, so there's no real plot arc to the movie. So the plot arc of the play is the stories behind these well-intentioned young people who have stars in their eyes and really believe that they are going to make a masterpiece that's going to launch their film careers and make them famous. And in their defense, there are several people that went on to have lengthy careers in the film industry. Rusty Russ, who plays a part called Sharon's brother that doesn't even have a name in the movie, went on to be William Russ, who is in, he's the second guy through the door in everything. You have most recently and clearly seen him as the father in American History X. Dave Marsh, who plays the artist who's trapped behind a painting, coined the term punk rock, wrote for Cream magazine and Rolling Stone, and was one of the founders of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Jock worked in the film industry for 35 years. But I think that George only made one movie, which was Deathbed, and so it's sort of like his Confederacy of Dunces.
So we understand there's no plot arc, there's no characterization.
None.
But those aren't the only reasons this is the worst movie ever made. There are other reasons. I heard from an insider, and if she decides to reveal herself during this discussion, I'll let you know.
Okay.
But she said that it was important to make this a feature-length film, and for that reason, there were additions. Can you tell us about that?
Right. They ran out of money, which I think is a common problem in independent film. And I would really like to remind people, this was 1973. This isn't today where, you know, you can get together some friends and somebody's got a flip camera and you're going to put this up on YouTube. I mean, you had to buy camera stock. And, you know, that was expensive. They had to borrow Jock's movie camera, which cost as much as the car he owned. And so they ran out of money. They couldn't even shoot the credits on it. And to be a feature-length movie, you really need to be 90 minutes. So, for example, when you start watching the movie, the first 2 minutes are just a dark screen with the sound of somebody eating an apple that was dubbed in over it.
The sound of someone eating an apple.
Yeah.
Over a dark screen.
A dark screen, dubbed in later. And there are a whole variety of upsetting, strange moments like that where you keep thinking that your television is malfunctioning or this just can't be real and nobody spent money on it. But in fact, they did. A large part of the movie just sort of slows down to a crawl. It's 7.5 minutes of Diane getting dragged back into the bed by the curtains.
And Diane is one of the main characters.
Yeah, yeah.
So the bed grabs her and she gets dragged
back. Yeah, in probably the worst death scene ever on screen.
And that this keeps happening to make the film longer so that it will be a feature.
Sure. Yeah.
And I also heard there were some issues around the quality of the acting in the film.
Issues? That's kind. Nobody can act in the movie. And I'm not really being mean when I say that. And the moment that I really realized that, now keep in mind, I probably have watched Deathbed 200 times.
Wow.
Between December and now. So like I'm really in Deathbed land mentally. But the moment that I heard actors from Wilmington with talent and craft actually read parts of the script that George had written, I was like, oh, wow, this had potential. This could have been really
It's
so
scary if a bed starts to eat you.
You know?
I hear that there's a lot of deadpanning going on.
Oh,
the bed will
yeah.
start to eat it's someone who's in it, and there's no facial expression change.
At all. No, and it's very kind of 70s B cult movies, but almost like on steroids. It's fun. and as I think Steve Vernon kind of sums up best, he's like, the monster, you have to recline for the monster to eat you in Deathbed. You have to actually recline. Like, if you go see Jaws, you're scared to go to the beach for a month. I've never been scared to take a nap after seeing Deathbed. You know?
So it's a horror film that is not scary.
No.
Another reason it's the worst movie ever made.
Yeah. They ran out of money. I think it had great potential. So can I tell you a little bit about its journey?
Please.
Okay. So George, they wrap principal photography in 73. We can put that in quotes. By 77, they had a rough edit, and they still did not have credits on it. It was going to cost them at least another $3,000 to shoot the credits, and they couldn't even come up with the money for that. And so the print that most people have seen of Deathbed just has George Berry copyright 77, and George started sending it out looking for a distributor. He never found one, and with the rise of home video in the early 80s, he's like, well, maybe I could get a straight-to-video distribution. And one of the people he sent it to pirated it, told him they weren't interested, sent him back the print, and released it in England and never told him.
So the movie is released in Europe now.
Yes.
And this is in the 80s.
This is in the early 80s.
And he doesn't know because at that time,
how would he have
found
out?
People were not on the...
on the internet world. And so it went on to become this cult movie classic in the UK. And in a way, it's kind of like the Searching for Sugar Man story. Nobody in England had any idea who George Berry was or what was going on with him. And then at some point, it got dubbed into Spanish. And it's like the Rocky Horror of Spain. People go as a midnight movie and dress up as the characters and talk back to the screen. And that's this whole other side, like reality.
So this is a cult film in Spain.
In Spain.
People go.
Yes.
And you compared it to the Rocky Horror Picture
Show.
They
dress up as
where
the
characters. They act out.
Yes.
Does somebody play the deathbed or is that just...
I haven't seen it. Okay. I would assume somebody would have to.
You and Jock need to take a trip to Spain.
I know. It would be great. So in like 2001-ish, George literally at 3 o'clock in the morning while playing around on the internet stumbled on this thread in a film forum about Deathbed. And it turned out to be his movie that he had made in 1973 and he thought was in his attic and that nobody ever knew about. And it turns out it was this huge thing in Europe. And not unlike the Sugar Man story, which is also Detroit related, because George is in Detroit. The movie was made in Detroit. He gets in touch with the guy who had started the thread and said, by the way, I'm George Berry and I made the movie. And he's like, I thought you were dead. I didn't think you were real. And as a result of that, he succeeded in getting the DVD release in 2004, which is what both Bob Mandello and Patton Oswalt have seen.
You're listening to Coastline. We are talking with Gwenifer Roller, local writer and playwright who is adapting the worst movie ever made, Deathbed, The Bed That Eats, to the stage. Gwenifer, as you said earlier, you have a local producer for this. This will be on a local stage. Tell us about that.
Big Dog, the last two weekends of October, it's going to be part of the Halloween Horror Festival. The world of playwriting is an interesting thing. And as somebody who writes about playwrights and also somebody who is a theater reviewer, I spend a lot of time thinking about this process and talking with people who lived with this process, et cetera. And it's I would say it's a very schizophrenic thing for many people because as a writer, you're sort of alone in your head with your computer. And then as a playwright, you get to a point where you have to hear other people read it because you have to hear the script. And so there's this collaborative element and then it goes back. But because Deathbed started as a show that had a production date, from the beginning, this has been a collaborative effort with Steve Vernon and as we go through it. So it has not been sort of the normal writing process. We've been through about 8 or 9 different drafts at this point, none of which remotely resemble each other.
And I heard from this anonymous insider, if she will ever reveal herself, I don't know if she will. She was part of one of those readings. So when you cast this thing...
I have no responsibility for that. Steve does all of that.
What would the ideal cast be? What would they look like? And I can understand if you don't want to name names in the local community, but can you cast it with movie stars so we can get sort of an idea of who would be in this show?
I guess that would be tough for me because since I am so much more immersed in the Wilmington stage world than I am in mainstream cinema, and I will admit that there are two people I have had in mind the entire time that I've been writing it for the two leads. You also have to realize that Jock is one of the main characters in the show.
The builder of the deathbed.
The builder of the deathbed. And, of course, it's it's depicting a time in his life before I was even born. So it's a very interesting idea to conceptualize who the person you've spent your entire adult life with was before you were even a thought in the world.
And who is the other main character?
It's George. It's George Barry.
George Barry.
I don't know. We call the female lead Jessica, like Jessica Rabbit, because the person she was in real life was Jock always describes her as va 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 voom, mm-hmm. you know. And then there's
that's evocative.
And then there's the film's editor kind of would have sort of a Peter Lorre kind of quality to him. He's a chain smoker who is kind of the cynical voice of reason throughout things.
Now, the man who wrote the original screen, George Barry, who mm-hmm. made the original movie, he also ran a bookstore for many years.
Yes, yeah. We connected bookstore owner to bookstore owner. Because his film career didn't take off, and he had two really wonderful children. And so he opened a bookstore in Detroit and was incredibly happy doing that and was really at the front lines of when ABE books and online exchanges came on.
All right. And it just very quickly, just a few seconds left, can you tell us how Jock was able to get the bed to eat?
Oh, yeah. It's done with air mattresses, Mr. Bubble, glycerin, and all of the yellow food coloring in the greater Detroit area.
That's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Thalian Hall's Tony Rivenbark, Shane Fernando of Cape Fear Community College's Humanities and Fine Arts Center, and Gwenifar Roller of Old Books on Front Street. Thanks to all of our listeners and those of you who emailed us today to join the conversation. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Join us next week when we take a closer look at climate change and what it means for southeastern North Carolina and how coastal communities can adapt. That's next week, Wednesday, August 6th at 2 p.m. here on WHQR 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Lindsay McGrath. Music editor is Bob Workman. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of our listeners and our guests and not necessarily of WHQR Public Radio or our licensee, Friends of Public Radio Incorporated. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.